Welcome to episode 69 of the Camerosity Podcast, the world's number one open source film photography podcast. My name is Mike Ekman, and we are back for another episode of Camera Gas Collecting Photography Film Fun. We've got an exciting episode planned for you all tonight, but before we get to that, let's do some introductions. First up, from Yellow Springs, Ohio, directly in the path of last week's total solar eclipse, is our very own camera delivery man, Mr. Paul Reibel. Hey, Paul, did you remember to wear those special eclipse glasses while staring at the sun?
We sneer at eclipse glasses in Ohio. We don't need no stinking eclipse glasses.
Next, from Sydney, Australia, where there won't be a total solar eclipse until July 2028, is Mr. Theo Panagopoulos. Hey, Theo, I know it's not as exciting as a vision-damaging celestial event, but did you hear the news that Bluey and her family moved to a new house?
Oh, wow, that's pretty exciting. Considering I have absolutely lost track of what Bluey is doing these days.
And finally, from the swamps and marshes of unincorporated Gainesville, Florida, is our own snake wrangler, Mr. Anthony Rue. Hey, Anthony, have you ever been bitten by a venomous snake?
Luckily, I've not been bitten by a venomous snake, but we've got coral snakes and diamondback rattlesnakes and pygmy rattlesnakes and cottonmouths all lurking around in the front yard. So, you know, give it enough time and I'm sure it'll happen.
For this episode, we are very excited to talk to our special guest, a man who I am sure all of you know. Anyone who has ever picked up a film camera and searched for a manual to learn how to use it has certainly been directed to this person's site. As the keeper of the largest online collection of camera manuals, we can only be talking about Mr. Mike Butkus. Mike, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hello there.
You want to do a better job of introducing yourself than I did?
I'm Mike Butkus. I'm stuck out here in Jersey. We just finished our earthquake we had over here that didn't rattle that much, but I'm sitting here. I stopped for a little while scanning manuals that I keep finding and keep buying and posting them on my site. So
I wonder if there was any connection between the earthquake and the eclipse, you know? I mean, big cosmic events.
In my area of the country, this is the year of the 17-year cicada emerging from the ground too. So we're going to have giant zombie bugs emerging from the ground just to die, a total solar eclipse, and earthquakes all over the United States. Plus, it's a U.S. presidential election, so that's going to be fun.
Are you going to try and macro photograph them, Mike?
That's true. I do have a Yashica dental eye. I've been looking for reasons to shoot super close-ups of things that aren't teeth. I opened up the waiting room. We have Howard Sandler. AJ's back, and a name I don't recognize, Brian Zeman. Is that right, Brian?
Yep, you got it.
All right, Brian, you want to quickly introduce yourself?
Hi. I'm Brian Zeman. I guess longtime listener, first time attendee. So I've been shooting film for quite a little while, actually. Got out of it for a number of years, was going to go ahead and get back into photography. And originally I'd planned to be shooting digital, but I wanted to go ahead and try to adapt old film lenses into digital. And being a fan of Nikon, I found that wasn't really the most easily done thing. And then somehow took a hard turn back into film photography and a heavy eBay addiction. So, now I'm here. So, do a little bit of everything. I'm kind of all over the place on formats, do quite a little bit of everything, actually. So earlier this evening, I was out shooting on my newly acquired Rolleiflex, and I'm pretty happy about that. And that's just kind of what I do in a nutshell.
And where are you located, Brian?
I am actually in Eastern Iowa, actually, just outside of Iowa City, as a matter of fact.
Eastern Iowa. Okay, you're in the land of Mike Novak. I don't know if you've ever had a chance
to meet him before. I've seen many of his posts around, actually, and a lot of his work.
Yeah, awesome. Well, welcome to the show. We'll be sure to talk. We also had Ray Nason's back too. So, hey, Ray, good to see you again. But our big guest, you guys have seen the name online. There's no way you could collect cameras and have never stumbled upon Mike Butkus's website. Mike has a section kind of in about me. You wrote a little post about why you started the site, but I thought maybe we could kind of cover some of the things that you have in there just to kind of give sort of an origin story, like as if this was a Marvel movie. No. You know, so I'll kind of start it off and maybe you could kind of fill it in for us too. But it sounds like you've been doing this since like 94, which is, I mean, like ridiculous.
I worked at a college and we had internet back in 1992, a nice little T1 line, which was one megabyte. And then the teacher started to get the new thing called video projectors for their classrooms. And they got a grant. They bought a video projector for the auditorium. And with that was a scanner. And since I wanted to learn how the scanner worked back in, that would be 1999, I found two cameras, two Chinon cameras, and their manuals. And I thought they were real interesting. So I learned how to scan on this college scanner, which was at the time $1,000. And that was $19.99 price, and learn how to scan, and then learn how to do optical character recognition. So on the original manuals I have going way back up until 1903 or something like that, the reason they're in Word format, and then I changed them to PDF files, actually scanned every individual picture, and then OCR'd the little words on each page, and then sat there for hours and glued them all together. And it took me a long time to do each manual. And I started with Ricoh cameras, and then I started with Pentax cameras because they were K-mounts. That's what I use all the time. And then came Canon with a scanner that could make your scan of the whole page into a PDF file. And that was like a lifesaver.
Yeah.
I could scan a manual in less than a half hour rather than 2 hours.
And I've noticed it myself, because I've looked through your site hundreds of times, and I have noticed some of those older HTML versions of manuals. It seems like on occasion you do go back and rescan them as PDFs. Is that like a goal that you have?
The real popular ones, you know, okay. The Pentax and, you know.
So on your site, I don't know who, like how you host it, but do you get like metrics that would tell you which sites are the, or I'm sorry, which manuals are the most popular? Or do you get any kind of insights on like what kinds of things people are visiting you for?
I put the Google Analytics on there back in 2012, but basically that's for advertisement. I hate to say it, but it does tell me what people are searching for, the top search names, and I look at it once in a while.
But does that kind of help steer you to fill in gaps of different brands or whatever, or is it just you take what you can find? No, okay.
I take what I can find. Whatever's on eBay. I've searched eBay UK. I've searched eBay UK and eBay Ireland, but a lot of those people don't ship overseas.
Right.
But I've gotten a lot of stuff that is not sold in the U.S. Right here, you know, the old Pratica camera, they weren't sold here in the U.S. that much. So that's why I search other sites.
Now, do you have a account? Like, do you know exactly how many you've put up there?
Oh, I have some 6,000.
6,000. Okay. Wow. And do you have the original paper copies still? Like, do you keep them in your home?
Oh, yeah. I have a dark room that is full of camera manuals.
Well, Mike, how could somebody help you? I mean, if you're still buying manuals, obviously there are things that you don't have. Do you have a list somewhere that you're of ones you're looking for? Because no. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people who would like to just donate them to you to thank you for everything you've done.
I get that. I have a couple of boxes of many things people just send me, and they just put them in a box to me, and I'm like, nope, got it.
Personally, I've offered you manuals and you've been very kind about it, but you've always told me, yep, I got that one.
I got that one. Yep.
It'd be great if we could help you find ones to, you know, to fill in your missing links.
I don't know which ones I don't have. It's not like baseball cards where you know what players you don't have. I don't know. You know, I know I have almost every Pentax camera, film camera they have, every Canon camera, you know, Ricoh. I have, you know, tons of Ricoh manuals.
Do they have to be actual physical copies, Mike? Or would you accept if someone, say, like I'm in Australia and sending stuff across the world is a bit
Oh, yeah, that
pricey. So would you accept soft copies to actually put up on your site?
People write to me and say, I have this one. Would you like a copy? And I say, you know, I check myself and say, yes, I don't have that one. But 50% of the time or more, the people don't know how to scan. They'll scan the whole flatbed. And I got to sit there and spend a half an hour cutting the sides off and cutting the tops off. And one guy sent me one where he photographed it with his fingers holding the pages with his camera and sent me a JPEG of each. And the things are bent a little. And I'm like, okay, I'll post it because I don't have it. And I've never seen that camera, so I'll post it for now. And, you know, maybe somebody will say, hey, I've got a better copy.
Well, I guess what we can do is put out a message. And anybody listening, if you do have something that's not on Mike's site and you want to send it through as a scanned copy, please scan it properly.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I do a lot of scanning too. And I mean, it takes work. It's, you know, and every scanning software works slightly different too. So even if you have a process that works well for you, whatever program you're using to do the scanning may be different than what the other person has. And I've switched, like when I scan my negatives, going from like Silverfast to the Epson's native scanner, you got to like relearn it all over again. So depending on which model you have, depending on which software you use, it's, you know, it's a steep learning curve to scan something that looks good. I've tried to send you a few things and I do my best to, you know, crop them and make sure everything's like straight and my fingers are in there too. You know, you pride yourself in your introduction about how you're a one-man show. You know, you do this all by yourself. I know your wife kind of helps out a little bit with some of the payments, I think, the donations. But, you know, to do everything you've done and keep it running for, you know, basically, you know, you said, okay, so 99, it's 2024. So, I mean, your site is a quarter of a century old. You know, I don't collect anything other than cameras. So I don't know if there's a Mike Butkus for vintage refrigerator collectors or watch or typewriters or anything like that. But I have to imagine that our hobby is unique in that we have such a treasure trove of manuals. And I'm constantly surprised at these weird cameras where it's like, there's no way he's got that. And four out of five times you do, you know, even some of the really obscure ones, because, you know, a lot of the reviews that I do are for less common cameras. And if, you know, I can definitely tell where your interest kind of tapers off to the more digital era. You don't see quite as much stuff from that era there. But when it gets into the meat and potatoes of the mid 20th, even the second half 20th century cameras, you have so much. And it's so great to have access to that. To find that kind of information is just really, really hard. So your site is something that needs to be preserved at whatever point in time you're done. Please, it doesn't have to be me. It doesn't have to be any of us, but.
Oh, I have a son.
Okay.
I have a son and a grandson.
Awesome.
Grandson's
yes.
Five. So you're looking at 2065 and he'll say, okay, that's it. I'm not doing it for grandpa anymore.
Well, all right. Well, I probably won't be around then either. So I guess that'd be all right. But. But no, I mean, I hope you realize, and I'm sure you do, but I hope you realize how helpful having that information out there has been to so many people. And that's why I try to link to you whenever I can, you know, and just try to throw as much traffic your way. And I know you do the donations. Are people generally pretty generous or like, I mean, I'm not expecting you to give me dollar amounts, but do you get a fair share of donations?
Oh, yeah.
You do? Okay.
I have money to buy stuff. So that's all I care about. As long as I pay the bills, I have two websites to pay and the domain names. And some of them are cheap. And Butkus.org is from the original company, the domain names.
All I could tell you is stay away from GoDaddy.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah.
I had them for about 2 years and I gave up because they wanted, I forget how much per month to have a secure site. The you know, HTTPS. I was like, that's per month? What are you, crazy? So I went to HostGator and they did it for free and they had little instructions. Do this. Boom. Okay.
I want to throw it out there to some of our people that are on the line. If you guys have any questions for Mike or is there...
I have a quick question for Mike.
Yeah.
So Mike, have you ever picked up a camera yourself and then realized, damn, I don't have a manual for this?
I don't collect cameras.
Oh.
People write to me all the time with my camera's doing blah blah blah. I'm like, okay, let me go to the manual. I have about 20 Pentax cameras and a Kodak Taurus, because bought one. I was going to show the kids where I worked at what a camera really looked like. And they're like, what? What is that thing? And I'm like, this is not your cell phone. You got to pull this out. You got to open the back. You got to put, what? It's crazy.
But do you shoot any of the Pentaxes?
Once in a great while.
I'd be so tempted that as you get these manuals in for some of these crazy old cameras, I'd be looking at the manual and going, I just got to get one of these to try this. You know, this is just too cool.
I've done the same thing, actually.
Looking at three more manuals I have to scan, I found 2 days ago in a box that I didn't know I had.
What are they?
An Olympus Infinity Twin, Kodak Snappy. People love the Kodak cameras, the point and shoots, because they continue to work. And a Rolly point and shoot model.
Well, I got to tell you, Mike, you may have seen this already online, but Mike Ekman and I wound up with a rather large collection of stuff, which was about over 4,000 cameras. And when we're trying to figure out what they are and how they work and everything, your site has been, I mean, you think we've been doing this for a long time, we would know how cameras work, but that's not true. I mean, there are always something weird about a camera that really requires a manual. And your website has just been terrific. The Orphan cameras. We were trying to come up. We were going to play Stump Butkus, where we would come up with cameras that we were sure you would not have a manual for.
Sure, I don't have.
We couldn't find any. I was going to say a Faranya Ibis because it's such an odd little weird camera. And I looked in your Orphan cameras page. You had it. So. There you go. Then I said, okay, well, I'm going to do a Graflex jet. You had that one.
Oh,
then
yeah,
I was
the jet.
A Kawa SETR. You had that one. I can't think of any that you don't have.
I also use photobooks.com, which is a manual and camera photography store in Washington State. And I look there sometimes when I'm looking for a particular brand, and I just search there and cross off the ones I already have and maybe buy four or five of them from there.
Hey, Mike, way back when I was a member, I'm still a member of the Photographic Historical Society of New England, one of the oldest camera clubs in the United States. And there was a gentleman, John Craig, who started doing this about 50 years ago, and he passed on. I've seen he never had a website per se with data and information. It was just a place to purchase manuals. And for the longest time, he would only sell photocopies or Xerox copies.
No.
He would never sell a hard copy. Have you ever had any dealings with him or his remains?
No, it doesn't ring a bell. There was a guy who had a website who he died back in 2014, and his wife kept it going.
That's what we're talking about.
Oh, okay. Met him way back in the 80s.
Yeah, that's right.
We had a place in Wayne, New Jersey called Second Sunday.
Yes.
He'd be there with his little boxes and his photocopies and be selling his instruction manuals. And that kind of disappeared in the mid-90s, I think.
Yeah, he passed away, and I think his wife put the entire business up for sale.
$130,000.
But it's really cool that you're offering these downloads, having your website. We've all used it, so just want to thank you.
So that's what it's about. I'm a librarian. By trade, I guess. I graduated college with a teacher librarian, and the teacher part went real fast, and the librarian part went pretty good until technology came. And then I moved on to technology because, you know, they were paying us a lot more than the teachers were, because nobody wanted to know that stuff and could care about it. So I got into technology. That's how I got at the college. Because I was in charge of the computer lab. We had, back in 1987, we had six computers, which back then was like very, very unusual.
On the topic of stumping, you know, Mike, or finding a camera that doesn't have, a tip that's worked well for me is there have been multiple times where I've looked on Mike's website for a manual and he doesn't have it. But then I find out that it is there, just maybe under a different name. You know, a lot of times cameras were sold under different names in the United States,
oh, yeah.
Europe versus Japan. And one that I have that I'm working on a review for right now is the Konica Recorder, which is this little half frame, you know, collapsible camera. And if you search your site for Konica Recorder, it's not there. So it's like, okay, he doesn't have this one, but it is there. It's just under a different name, Konica AA35.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and that's, I guess it's more of a tip for other people if they are looking for a manual. And if at first they don't find it, look, see if that camera ever was sold under a different name. And there's a good chance that you might actually have it under a different name.
Camera Wiki, the website of
photography,
you look there and you it was sold under this name in the UK. It was sold under this name in another country. So I go there too and find out before I buy the thing and go, I know I had this manual and it's under a different name.
Anybody have any other questions for Mike?
I just wanted to say, I'm a bit of a younger person. I'm in my 20s, actually, and I've been collecting a lot of older cameras recently, and Mike's site has been so extremely helpful in figuring out some weird features on some of these cameras. I recently picked up one of the 1930s 620 cameras by Kodak, and I was trying to look on the manuals. There's this one specific lever on it that I have no idea what it does. And it's not in any of the manuals, but still it helped me figure out a lot of the other features in them. But it's just nice to finally talk to you about it, you know?
And you know what, Jordan, you're speaking now. You joined in after we did the intros. Yeah. You want to say hi real quick and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Jordan. I've been a photographer for a little while, about 10 years now, but I started getting into film and older cameras in general in the last year or so.
Okay.
And I actually met Anthony here at Filmstock 2023.
Oh, in Atlanta?
Yeah, and that's how I figured out about your guys' podcast, and I've been enjoying listening to it. And it kind of inspired me to start looking at random cameras that no one really knows about.
You found the right website. Yeah.
And I actually have one camera in my possession that Mike does not have a manual for.
What is it?
It's the original Mamiya 6, specifically the 4 models. Technically, they sold it as to Olympus, but it's completely functionally different. But it's not a difficult camera to use, but it's very interesting. Not a lot of people talk about it.
There were a lot of variants of the Mamiya 6, and I have four of them. And you're right, there's a lot of different variations of that camera, and a lot of them have different features.
Mine is really strange. It's a 4S, but it has like the earlier 4 plates on the back, but it doesn't have the 6-4-5 window. And then it has the older Sette Gaia Koki lens on it. I'm really confused with this thing, but it's a beautiful camera to use.
Well, an interesting thing about the Mamiya 6 is historically significant in that it was made both before and after the war.
Mm-hmm.
But after the war, the Mamiya 6 was the very first Japanese-made camera to resume production after the war.
Yeah.
And even before the war, though, the earlier models, photography was so expensive, and they didn't have it as easily the resources to fire glass and make optical glass, that to sell that camera with a lens and shutter was prohibitively expensive for the Japanese people. Yeah. So there are variations of the Mamiya 6 that you could buy from Mamiya without a shutter and lens. They would sell the camera to you, the body, the bellows, the plate, but no shutter and lens, and you would just put whatever you had. So a lot of these earlier photographers would have the early Mamiyas, and I think I'm a little rusty because it's been a while since I've read my notes, but I'm fairly certain they continued that practice in like 46, 47 maybe, where you could buy that camera and just fit whatever lens or shutter is on there. So from time to time, you'll find people who will come up with Mamiya 6 models that have a strange combination of lens and shutter. And that's why, because maybe they did have an Olympus camera that died, or some Photoshop was able to get a bunch of junk German compers or something that they were able to adapt and make it fit to that camera. To find a manual for all the variations is hard.
Yeah.
The beauty of that camera is the parts are fairly interchangeable across a lot of the models. So even these days, when you actually take one to a service person and say you have a broken piece, you can find a donor camera from a different model and they just transplant bits. And you end up with it, like Mike said, it's a very interesting variations that just don't make sense or don't seem to be anywhere. And there's a lot of confusion over the actual cameras themselves in terms of the models, because they went through a really fast cycle of modifications, And I've struggled, you know, it's one of the cameras I've sort of shown a bit of interest in, and I've struggled to find good instructions or good model descriptions for those as well.
I actually have two of these, and I use the other one for parts, and I was just recently interchanging the entire rangefinder assembly, and I was like, there's so many weird subtle differences between these two.
and then you'll post a picture and someone will say that's a Model 5 or someone, and then someone else will say no, that's a Model 4 2 or something, and the debate starts to rage on. They're both kind of right here, so I'm not sure.
But the lenses on them are beautiful.
Yeah, and then the Mamiya released the electronic Mamiya 6, which is a completely unrelated camera with the exact same name. So
yeah,
they certainly didn't help us that much.
But you know what's really good about the Mamiya 6? It was the predecessor to the best camera ever, the Mamiya 7.
The Mamiya 8.
That's like my Leica.
Oh, the wooden one? Yes.
That's a wood dial 3F.
That's a wood dial. It's a it's an oak 3.
And speaking of your Leicas, Ray, the 3A you sold me, I just got back from Alan Wade. He swapped out the curtains, brand new curtains on it, cleaned the entire shutter mechanism, re-lubed it. The rangefinder actually was spot on accurate already, but he kind of cleaned a little bit of haze off the glass too. So the one you sold me, the reason I liked it so much is it had a glorious patina. It really, and that's what appealed to me to it, is it just had that right amount of Lenny Kravitz patina to it. But now it works perfectly. So I'm really excited to get a shot to shoot it.
If it makes you feel any better, I'm preparing for the Boston show this weekend, a little bit today. And I came across another 3A I purchased with a Sumar that I can't open up. I got to send the Sumar off. But this camera is immaculate. It's one of the cleanest screw mounts I've ever seen in my life.
I wouldn't mind a Sumar. It's just I've never been able to find one that you could see through.
Yeah, that's. I got these big flakes. These big flakes are in there right now. It's like it's delaminating on the coating and the lens inside. Having a heck of a time finding these treasures. You know you're getting old and you have too many cameras when you start finding things that you forgot you purchased.
I think that's happened to everybody here, to be honest with you.
That's why I keep a spreadsheet now.
I do my best, but I buy a lot.
I just wanted to add my voice to those praising Mike Butkus for the service he provides to our film community. Like it's not only that, you know, you could find out about a camera you've bought that you're going to use, but even cameras that you buy and you decide it's not for you and you're going to sell it. It's so nice to be able to tell the seller like this, you know, how do I use this thing? Just go to Butkus and put in the model number and you'll probably, you know, send a link or whatever. And I think you're the only one besides Ekman that has a family name that has become a verb. Like just go Butkus the model. You'll find out how to use it. Also, I believe there's some value added. I have a few that I've downloaded and I think that there's been comments written in the margins with more information than the manual. Like, I think it was one of these cameras where the leaf shutter, you know, you shouldn't put it to the highest speed after you've cocked the shutter. And it didn't say that in the manual. And it was written in like, beware, don't do this. Or maybe it was the Voigtlander Ultramatic, something about don't put it in automatic aperture mode until it's wound or something like that.
I also have flashes and light meter manuals. I have a couple hundred of them. Somebody asked for one. Back in 2003, I was like, sure, okay. And then never realized how many light meters there were.
I think I have one of those Metz Hammerhead. I think it's 45 CT5 is the one I have. And like, I think I would never, like, you put like 8 AA's in it or some insane number of batteries. And you can't really see the markings for which way the batteries go in on the plastic. And I think I really had to rely on the manual to see a picture of how the batteries go into the battery holder for that.
One area of your site for my own personal interest that I would love to see expanded is you have a small section of camera catalogs. You have a couple Sears and Montgomery Ward catalogs. And that, I love those.
I put them up back in 2004, and in the 20 years I've had it, I have maybe one or two people have said, oh yeah, I looked at your so-and-so, so I have a bunch I'm just going to throw away.
No!
Nobody nobody ever said. Some of them are already gone. I think I put them in the recycling.
Mike, don't throw them away. Mike Ekman will send you a shipping label.
A shipping label?
I will give you a shipping label. Just put them in a box and send them to me.
That reminds me, I recently purchased a camera from my boss, and I wish I grabbed it. It had a catalog for the first line of Canon FD lenses for like all the SSC and stuff, with like detailed diagrams of the lens elements and sample photos. And I wish I had held on to it and scanned it.
I created a new folder called Lenses, because people asked. So I've got like 30 books of Canon, Mamiya 645 lenses. So if you look on the left-hand side, there's lenses, and there's a whole list of the lens manuals that I was going to throw away. And one or two or three or four people started to say, how do you do this with, or which one fits this or whatever. There's 30 or so manuals of just lenses for different cameras.
It was like the summer of 2019. I was talking to Johnny Sisson, and he had mentioned to me that they had in the basement at Central Camera all of their old catalogs, like every year. He said they had like Burke and James catalogs, some of the other, Paul, what were some of the other Chicago camera stores back then?
Well, Calumet, of course, Helix, Burke and James, Burley Brooks were the two major distributors of it.
He said Don had boxes of them. And I'm like, I want them. And, you know, Johnny was like, I'll get them to you. And I was like, well, I want them. He's like, well, I'll get them to you. And we never did. And then the place caught fire. And that's some of the stuff that got lost. So, you know, boxes of antique paper, I'm sure, is the first thing to burn up. But so that's gone. I mean, I would love, that's part of the appeal to me to the historical parts of my reviews, is when I can find those old reviews. I don't just love cameras. I love the way things were even advertised, just the way that the layouts were done. You could tell these people laid this stuff out by hand, and just the way things were illustrated back then. It's just advertising was so different back then than how it is now. And being able to flip through those old catalogs and the rare instance where, because I have like one or two paper Central Camera catalogs, but you know, you have a couple. There is a website that has a few of them, Chicago area camera catalogs and such. But I would love to find a depot of old camera catalogs. Montgomery Ward's, Sears had really awesome camera catalogs too. They're so pretty.
Pacific Rim Cameras puts a lot of them out.
Yeah, yeah, Mike Otto.
I find it. It's I like that. There's some vintage Linhof catalogs from the 60s and. I just find it ironic because invariably they show, you know, a pretty woman holding up the camera, but you know that those Linhof cameras are like 6 to 8 pounds, right? And they're it just seems ironic to me.
You can't talk about pretty women in cameras without Miranda's.
But they don't show them holding the camera. They show them modeling for the camera.
Yeah, that's true.
I like your remarks on the advertising aspect, because I have a huge collection of old Nat Geo magazines from 1972 up to 1996.
Uh-huh.
And there's so many amazing camera ads in there. Yeah. It's like the illustrations are so beautiful and they're so well photographed and put together. I love seeing stuff like that.
Jordan, it's fun. It's fun you say that, because last year I started doing that. I bought on eBay $8 a 30-year collection of Nat Geo.
Oh, wow. I have it. I have one for each month of each year. From 1972 to 1996, it's a huge collection of Nat Geo magazines.
Mine is in the garage. It starts in the 60s, and I haven't had a chance to go through it. But I have been buying old catalogs of magazines, the annuals that have, again, just for the ads, that are just remarkable with all the detail.
Yeah.
And hey, Mike Ekman, I got some stuff I'll bring my next trip when I come to Chicago.
Sure. Yeah.
Some pretty cool dealer catalogs.
Pacific Rim is an awesome resource. I've spoken to Mike Ott. It's funny how Mike, the first name of Mike, a lot of us are archivists. Wes Loader, his first name's actually Mike too. So you got four Mikes. Mike Otto does Pacific Rim. He's doing kind of the same thing you are, Mike Butkus, just kind of having the stuff freely available and just making it, you know, so that people have access to it, high quality scans and all their stuff. On my site, my Kepler's Vault series, nearly every scan that I use for those, plus a lot of the advertisements in my reviews, were scanned by a guy named Mark Bergman, who passed away in 2021. He lived out in Las Vegas, and he was great. I mean, anytime I needed something, he had pretty much every back issue of Pop Photo and Modern Photography from the 40s. You know, even Modern Photography was originally called Minicam. He had those magazines too. And if there was something that I knew was in, hey, Mark, I know that the August 1957 issue should have a review of this camera in it. Can you look and see? And he'd be like, yep, there it is. I'll scan it for you. And he'd post it for me. So he passed away, and I was able to get in touch with his brother. And he's like, yeah, we have a whole room full of just boxes and boxes of these magazines and books. And it's like, I don't know how the hell I would get that. I mean, first of all, I don't want boxes and boxes of anywhere books at all. But just to think that stuff is there, and I wanna get as much of it out there as possible, so that people like us and the people who follow us can have access to that information. I can't remember if I ever shared the story, but I did the Miranda ads. I had found a small pamphlet that talked about the guy, Hal Reef, who did a lot of the shots. And he referred to the lady who's in most of those ads as Nancy. And I never really knew if that was her real name. He didn't use a last name. There wasn't a lot of history. It was just more or less like how he did the shots. And I posted that on my site. It's still up there. But then like 2 years later, I got an email from this woman up in the New England area somewhere, maybe it was Massachusetts, but he's like, no, that's my grandma. That's her name really is Nancy. And you know, that's a totally true story. She was a model, and they would take these risque photos of her. And I was like, is she still alive? And she's like, yeah, she's like 92. And I was like, can I talk to her? She's like, no, you can't talk to my 92-year-old grandma about when she would like barely be wearing clothes and camera magazines in the mid-20th century. But I thought like that could be, there might be a cool story there, but I guess we'll never know. So Paul, question I have for you is, we had a guy who posted in the Camerosity group about possibly wanting to get rid of a large collection, you know, in this particular case, it was his cameras, but you know, you've done this, I've only done it once, but you've done the whole, I want, you know, dispersing us an estate of collections of cameras multiple times. If someone were in that similar situation, maybe their a loved one has passed away and they have a huge collection of cameras, like, what's your advice? Like, where does somebody start to unload a large collection of cameras?
It depends on what it is, but the number one thing is that you really have to be patient. When you have a lot of stuff, for example, let's say you had like 10 Pentax K1000s with lenses. The problem is you can't sell 10 of them at one time. And if you list 10 of them on eBay, you've just completely destroyed the market. So you don't want to do that. You really have to be patient with it. Do them one at a time. The other problem is that when you get a large collection, anything over 100 pieces, you can't expect somebody else, another reseller, to come and buy those things from you without really taking a bath on the price, because it takes a lot of time to check something. You know, if someone called me or you to come and look at their collection of things, it's just an incredible time sink to do it. So you really need to be patient with it and move it, you know, a little bit at a time. Don't think you're going to get rid of all of it in a week.
I liked what you said too, about if you have 10 of the same thing and you know that one of them is worth $500, you can't say, oh, well, 500 times 10 is what I'm going to get. You know, you might get 500 for the first one or the second one, but you keep selling too many of the exact same thing over and over again, there's a finite number of people who are going to pay a premium dollar, and the prices are going to go down as you keep selling.
I learned that early on in the photo business. There was a dealer in Columbus, Ohio, by the name of Chick Young, Chick's Camera Exchange, and Chick owned the whole block. I mean, he wasn't a collector. He was more of a hoarder, but a very sharp businessman. And I would go into his store and I'd look in the showcase and there'd be a Leica 3G in there with a nice lens on it. I'd say, Chick,
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. He said, oh, no, that's nothing. It's nothing. He'd open a drawer and seven more of them would come sliding to the front of the drawer. And I said, Chick, put them out. He said, no, no, I got one. I got one for sale. I said, when I sell that one, I'll put another one out. I said, well, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, it really does.
So that's where I learned that story.
Ray, were you going to say something?
If somebody wanted to liquidate quicker, there are other options, but you wouldn't maximize your dollar amount. And it happens all the time.
Well, and I think that's the most important question. That, to me, is the first question you ask the person, is how quickly do you want to get rid of this stuff?
Yep. Well, it's like Ray and I, you know, we buy collections.
Yeah.
And when we buy a collection, we realize going into it that it's going to take us a long time to sell it. There are going to be certain things that aren't going to sell at all. There'll be certain things that we spin off to other dealers because we don't want to mess with them. There are things that other dealers will spin off to us because they don't want to deal with them. And, you know, honestly, dealers sell more to dealers than they do to civilians.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, a lot more. We laugh about it and say, you know, why are we spending $75 for a table at a camera show? Let's just meet at a bar somewhere in the parking lot. And we'll trade equipment and somebody will buy something and somebody else will trade something for something. And there's really no point in even going to the show anymore.
Well, this Cincinnati show, the show was Saturday. I got in Friday. I sold late, very late. I mean, I had to drive 4 hours plus I lost an hour due to the time zones. But in the time I was there, I jokingly sent my wife a text message like, I don't even need to go to the show anymore. I could literally come home and I was able to get rid of not quantity. It was the high end stuff that I sold right away. So quantity wise, I sold more the day of the show, but these were, you know, $20, $30, $40 cameras. And, you know, if you're like, I think back to when I first started, you know, I would buy something and if I didn't like it or wanted to flip it, I would sell it on eBay for $20, $30, $40. And that was fine. You know, I didn't mind. But when you start doing volume, you know, Paul, for you to go through all of the Elmo Flexes and the, you know, the generic Japanese twin lens TLRs, which are fine cameras, there's nothing wrong with them. But it just gets to the point where I don't want to sit here and go through 20 of these cameras that are all basically the same or a whole bunch of Minolta SRTs. You know, if someone were to say, hey, I have a collection of 40 different Minolta SRTs by itself, depending on if it has a lens, that could be a $50, maybe even $100 camera. But there gets to be a point where it's just not worth it to put in the amount of time to sell that many of such a common camera. Because, you know, I don't even want to get into the difficulties with some buyers.
Mike, you also have to consider that you could buy a camera. Let's say it's a Minolta or it's a Leica or it's a Canon or a Nikon and it's working fine. But 3 years later, the foam's gone, you know, and that seems to be the case that it's a never ending battle. If you can't flip it quick, it's a never ending battle on making sure for your credibility as a reseller.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a huge, huge thing for me. I get a lot of people at shows. I'll be buying something. They're like, I want to buy that from you. I'm like, no, it's not for sale. And they're like, what do you mean it's not for sale? Well, I need to go through it with a fine comb and make sure it's working properly and make sure the seals are good and there's no, you know, issues. That's my integrity.
You need to have an alter ego. You know, you could be like, you know, I don't know, just make up a fake name and that could be your junk cameras.
Yeah.
Separate yourself.
I put a disclaimer on some of the recently I've been copy and pasting it into my listings on eBay and just say, look, I sell a lot of very old cameras. I have tested them as well as much as I can, but old cameras can be very cranky. And
that's right.
If I've made a mistake and I sell you something that isn't working, all you need to do is contact me and I'll make it right with you. But yeah. You know, I can't, there are certain things that a seller can't, just simply cannot catch everything that's going to happen.
No. I literally sold an Olympus Ace. I wasn't going to share this story, but I am now. I sold an Olympus Ace. The camera was dead. The shutter didn't work. It cosmetically was nice. Viewfinder was hazy. It was a beautiful display piece. And I sold it on eBay for like, the closing price was like $15.50. And I described it as is parts. Camera does not work. So the guy buys it, ship it to him. A couple of days later, I get a request to return. The lens is wobbly. It can't be fixed. And I was like, you bought a parts camera. He goes, well, you didn't list that problem. And I was like, really? You know, like I said, the shutter was dead. I said, the viewfinder was hazy. The camera does not work. Parts as is condition. Well, you didn't describe every problem it had. And I was like, you know what? If you need your $15 back, fine. Just send it back to me. I mean, part of me wanted to just give him his money back. I didn't want the camera back, but it was the principle, the idea. But those are the kinds of experiences where I'm just trying to get rid of something just so I don't have to look at it. And a $15 sale, a guy wants to nitpick that I didn't describe it in enough detail of all the problems that it had with it.
You know, buyers are funny, Mike. I sold a guy just recently, a 400 millimeter f/5.5 Telemagor, which is like a 9-pound lens. And I sold it as an exact amount. So this guy gets it and he says, I can't get it to stay on my camera because it'll fit and it'll bayonet in, but it won't lock. And I said, you know why? And he said, no, why? I said, because it's a Practina mount. I screwed up. Mm. And he says, oh, okay. So I did. It was my error. I knew it was a Practina mount, but when I made the listing, I listed it as an Exacta.
Can't you mount some Exacta lenses upside down? I think you can.
Yeah, you can. You can. Yeah. You can do them that way. But this one was definitely a Practina mount.
So did you sell them a Practina?
I didn't have one, but I have one. If you need one for your Practina, Anthony.
I was just going to jump here and say that, yeah, as an eBay ag, I've been seeing more with the popularity of film cameras. I've been seeing more sellers listing kind of, you know, verbiage like you were saying that this is an old camera. They're fiddly. I've tried to list what's wrong with it. But yeah, kind of the buyer, be aware that these are older pieces of equipment and, you know, in transit, things might happen. So.
But the worst part about it is it doesn't matter. I mean, you could type that, you know, but it really all they have to say is it's not as described. I mean, as the seller, there's nothing you could do about it.
It depends on how both parties actually act as well. I mean, you just got to be civil to each other. I bought that French, that Telka 3 recently. I think I mentioned it on a previous show.
Yeah.
And it came and look, the person selling had said, okay, there's a couple of things, and that was great. And they were correct, and I was willing to do that. I also found that the focus was stuck. I wasn't going to worry about that because it happens on old cameras. They need to be serviced, and you sort of grease it. But what I also found was that the actual rangefinder was not just showing up at all in when you look through the viewfinder. I said, look, that's going to be a problem that's probably a bit too far that I want to accept. That wasn't listed. So I contacted the seller. She said, look, I'm really sorry. It's my father's collection. I did the best I can with my knowledge. I'll send you a label and we'll send it back. And I sent her a note and said, look, yeah, it's, I understand. I collect cameras and I was willing to overlook some of it, but I couldn't go that far. But if you want to get it serviced, it's probably worth servicing. And I gave her Jess's, details. So she sent me a message back afterwards saying, oh, I just had a look at your site. It's fantastic. Love the way you've got your collection. And I'm contacting Jess to try and get this sorted because it's such a nice camera. And I said, well, once you've got that sorted, then we know that what the outcome is. We can talk about what, you know, maybe putting it up for sale again and I could consider buying it. It's just I don't want to buy something unknown that could potentially end up being a doorstop for me. And she goes, I fully understand. So, I mean, it was a very lovely transaction, even though I didn't end up with the camera.
Yeah, being nice to people helps too. It frustrated me that one buyer because I was doing my best to just say, this is a junk camera. You're paying parts for it. In fact, I sometimes get worried if I do list something as non-working and the prices start going up too high. It's like, oh, it's great to get a lot of money for something, but I've kind of had that concern where if it gets bid up too high, it's like, did these guys read the description that I put in there? But you never know. So, you know, back to my question for Paul, though, you know, Ray, you helped answer too, but I think understanding what your priority is, do you want speed or do you want max value? If you want max value, you got to have a ton of patience. If you just want to unload and just get rid of it and not have to deal with it, you know, expect to get 50 or even less percent of the value of the retail value of something, because the person that's taking care of the buying of that collection has to do something with it. And the amount of time is substantial.
Time, storage, shipping cost, And the fact that there'll be a lot of it will not sell at any price.
No, exactly.
People don't realize that. I mean, if you get a box full of stuff, it could go either way. You can either wind up with a lot of stuff that doesn't sell, or you can get to the bottom of the box and find a Muli motor, you know, yeah. or some little trinket, some little thing that's worth, you know, a lot of money. So you just never know as a buyer what you're getting into. So you have to protect yourself.
But if you do have a whole bunch of camera manuals, then we need to make sure we get that to Mike Butkus in case there's any.
You know, I figured out what I'm going to do because and Mike, I know you do too. We have stacks of manuals. So what I'm going to do is I'll go through the manuals. I'll go to Google and see if Butkus has them. If Butkus doesn't have them, then I'll ship them to Butkus.
Yeah, there you go. Make forth the effort to at least see if it's a Canon AE-1, then don't waste your time.
I'm pretty sure he's got one.
If it's the entire lineup of King Regulus, then you might have something there.
You know, Mike, to speak to something you were just talking about, as you know, somebody in my community, I'm kind of known as the old camera guy, and people will just show up at my work with boxes of cameras. You know, this is my grandfather's collection, and you know, or I was such an avid camera collector, and they're just, you know, collecting dust now, and here you can have them. And I'll look through those boxes, and I'd say that there may be one out of 50 that I'd even want to shoot. You know, most of it is just so valueless.
I feel bad.
You know, it's hard to tell somebody that, you know, thanks, but no thanks, but
right.
What people have collected and think has value, they're unfortunately not collecting like cool Zeiss Super Ikantas. You know, they're collecting, you know, like you said, Japanese TLRs or boxes or Voigtlander Brilliance.
Vest pockets.
Yeah. Oh, I've had at least 5 vest pockets Kodaks foisted upon me. You know, they're all just gummed up and dead, but display pieces, I guess.
Or Brownie Hawkeyes.
Brownie Hawkeyes, Duoflexes. Yeah. You know, the thing is that, and it happens to me too. It happens at camera shows because people will come up to you at camera shows with, you know, cameras they found at their grandparents' house. All you can do is just say, you know, this camera could tell a lot of stories about your family. And, you know, do you really want to get rid of it? Or why don't you just put it on the shelf and keep it and explain to your children, you know, and your grandchildren where it came from. You know, you probably have pictures that were taken with this camera.
Yep.
So it reaches a point where it means more as a family memento than it does as anything that has monetary value.
Well, Paul, you could just give them a handout on how to turn it into a lamp.
Here you go.
You know, I was just going to suggest that.
A three-way, you know, a nice three-way fixture, maybe with a dimmer on it, so you could change the colors of the light. It would be useful.
You could put a beautiful Edison bulb in this.
Yes.
And this place, send all your hate mail directly to Paul and Jordan. And accept that.
Yeah, I have an article about what is my camera worth. And at the very end of it is exactly what you just said there. And I say that maybe you shouldn't even sell it. You know, if that camera reminds you of your grandpa, or it's a picture that took, or I'm sorry, a camera that took pictures of you when you were a kid, its sentimental value is far more than what its retail value is. And I've had that experience before, Anthony, where somebody knows you as the camera guy and they come and they offer you the, you know, the Olympus trip or something, or it's a fine camera. It's just, it's like, I already have, you know, half a dozen of those, or I have no interest in it. Sometimes they don't care, but sometimes you sort of see that look of disappointment in their eyes. Like they thought, you know, that it's worth something, and it rarely is.
Yeah. If only it were a trip, usually it's like some sort of Polaroid that they haven't made film for in 30 years.
It feels like a great segue there for me, since it's episode 69. I'm kind of curious. I want to know, what's everybody's favorite 6x9 cameras?
I know what Anthony says.
So you're the guy that brought that up on Discord.
Okay. That's me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, where do I go? Okay.
It's in the name.
Now you've turned the dogs loose. Okay.
Well, I'm really glad he took 69 and went that direction. So,
yeah.
Well, I have several. I have a Century Graphic, which is nice because it's a 6x9 camera. You can get a little bit of tilt with. It's good for still lifes. I have a Zeiss. It's not an Iconta, it's a Netar. So it's the lens is a little bit lesser, but it's actually a really nice camera to use and could put a flash on it. It's got a shoe. I've got a Moskva, which has a rangefinder.
Well, those are
A
fantastic.
little bit finicky, not the later Moskvas are. I mean, the strut design is not as solid as Zeiss, that the Zeiss that it's based on. But the lens is Industar lens is superb.
Well, I got criticized by a reader of my site because I kept referring to all 120 roll film rectangular, 6x9 cameras. And I think it was in my review for the Kodak Metalist where I referred to it as a 6x9 camera. And this guy was very firm in correcting me that that is not a 6x9. It is 2.25 by 3.25. That's not how it was described. And I was like, all right, man, you're technically right. So if I'm allowed to include 2.25 by 3.25 cameras in that same group, then mine. I think Anthony is a big fan of the Kodak Metalist. But if I am limited to Japanese or German cameras, within reach, it is the Texas Leica, the Fujica GL690. I had the GSW 693 that I traded with Paul. Do you still have it, Paul?
No, I sold it.
You did sell it? Okay.
Yeah.
I like this camera better. Even though it's bigger and heavier, but it feels it's so solid and so big, but yet it feels like just they took a regular S rangefinder and just made it big. Like I get now why they call it a Texas Leica. So just take a M3 and supersize it, and that's essentially what this is. So
And it's a great self-defense tool too.
yeah, oh yeah, big time. Plus, it doesn't hurt that I have the 50 mil wide angle lens on it too, and I don't think I have another 6x9 that also has a wide angle lens on it.
Yeah, I've got the GSW 693, which you just mentioned. And that's one of my, the one I really like because it's the wide angle lens. So it's really, really
Yep.
nice.
The ergonomics.
Yeah, the ergonomics are really nice on it. It fits nice in your hand. It looks like a bit of a clown camera because it's so big, but it fits nicely. And it's not too heavy, that one. It's not as heavy as the one you just showed. So
No.
it's they obviously they progressed a little bit in terms of the materials, but the Super Aconta, that's one that I really enjoy, 6x9 as well. That's a beautiful camera, and the Besser, the Voigtländer Besser, I've got the one, which is something that's a lot of fun to use. And 6x9 negative from that is beautiful.
I'm kind of obsessed with the format. And if I were to start off, I'd say that regardless of what Mike's reader said, the Metalist is a 6x9 camera, and the Metalist would probably be my first choice. But then the aforementioned the Telca 3 as a folder is just super luxurious to shoot with, and it's got a great lens. It's the Super Iconta 6x9 is fantastic. I've got every iteration of the Bessa until up to the Cosina and Fuji iterations. The Voigtländer rangefinder from or the Bessa rangefinder from 1939 is hands down my favorite of all the Bessas. It's such a cool camera. And what else would I put on there?
Actually, we're both missing one. The Plaubal Makina with the rollback
Yeah,
is
I
a
was gonna
beautiful
say
six by nine.
the Plaubal. Or even my Voigtländer Berghail with the roll up 6x9 adapter on the back. Love shooting both of those cameras. I had to return the Plaubal that I had borrowed, and I miss it dearly. But the Berghail is also a fantastic camera to shoot 6x9. And and then the one that I covet is I hope that Paul still has it is the Horseman convertible.
Yeah, Mike and I each have a Horseman convertible at this point.
It's almost like a Rolly 35 in 6x9 format.
Yeah, it's the most compact of all. I mean, it's that camera, the camera itself is no bigger than the back. I mean,
Right.
it's an amazingly small
The
six by
film
nine.
back is exactly the same thickness as the body. So you have the lens, the film back, and then the body is occupies a third of the entire front to back thickness of the camera.
What, Theo, what were you holding up? What was that?
This is the Agfa Record 3 that you actually just sent me, Paul. It was
Oh,
from
right, with the
Mike.
red bellows.
Yeah, with the red bellows from Mike. This one looks like it's been Jürgened, so to
Yeah,
speak.
I think so.
This is a beautiful little camera. I mean, it's not the rangefinder isn't
It's
connected to
not
the
coupled.
focusing. It's not
It's
coupled.
uncoupled. Right.
Yeah, but it's. I mean, this camera is in beautiful condition. I'm actually looking forward to trying it out this weekend and getting some film through it.
That's a pretty basic camera, but Theo, I'm glad you have it because I wanted someone who would appreciate it because the Red Bellows is beautiful. It's clearly done by somebody recent. And that viewfinder, the range finder's spot on. All the shutter speeds work, no pinholes. Normally, your Agfa Record 3 wouldn't be a high dollar camera, but that one in that condition
Yeah.
looking as good as it does is very uncommon.
I have only one 6x9 camera. I want to invest in another one, but I have a 1946 Kodak Vigilant 620, which is a bit of a pain to shoot with because you need to either get 620 reels and adapt it to it. But I got it in practically mint condition for $15. The bellows don't even look like they've been opened at all. The lens had no fungus, no dirt, no like coating problems, and I shot several rolls of black and white through it, and it is stupidly sharp.
There's no pinholes.
No pinholes at all. There's no wear on the bellows.
Leave it open. Do not keep
Yeah,
closing it.
don't close it.
Yeah, I do keep it open on a
Yep.
shelf.
On those old bellows cameras, if you open one and it makes any sound whatsoever, you have pinholes.
Yeah.
So you're better off just to leave it open at
Leave it
this point.
open.
Yeah, and the camera I want to invest in, which are weirdly affordable, is a Horseman 970 field camera. That thing piques my interest a lot because you can get 6x7 and 6x9 roll film backs for it. And I do a lot of landscape stuff at night in like rural urban environments, so that thing would be
You know,
interesting.
I got a I that actually is a very nice camera.
Yeah.
I have right now, I think I have 4 6x9s. The best of two with the Apo Lanthar is probably the nicest one. But I also have a Plobel 69W Pro Shift, which has a 47mm super Angulon lens on it.
At least you have it at least until I sell enough plasma.
The Horseman convertible has a 65mm lens, but my favorite one, it was my first love. It was my second medium format camera that I've ever owned. I got it in 1969, and it's not the one I bought in 1969, but since 1969, I have never not had a Mamiya Super 23. I've probably owned 10 or 12 of them, and I have two of them right now, but that camera with the 50mm lens is just, to me, it's the perfect camera. It's heavy, it's bulky, it takes a 6x9 or 6x7 back, and it takes a ground glass back.
Ground glass back as well, yes.
Yeah, the ground glass back, because on the Super 23 and the Universal, which one has it, Ray? One of them has an extension on the back. It
The
has a
Super
fellow.
23.
Super
Super 23.
23 has the movements on the back, but the Universal is the one that took the Polaroid back.
That's right. And I have one of each of them right now. But I used to use the Super 23 for close-ups because you got a certain amount of extension with the bellows on the back. And you could do a little bit of perspective control, but not enough to make it anything that I tell people they could do.
I almost bought one of those from a friend of mine who is offering to sell it to me for about $120, and I declined it because
Yeah, you should buy it. You should buy it.
the roll
It's
film back is not working properly, and those can be a little
Buy
pricey.
another
Swap
one.
them out. Just get
They're
another one.
easy to get fixed. I mean, you can easily get them fixed, or you can buy another back. I mean, backs are plentiful and they're not expensive.
So, Jordan, another sort of sleeper Kodak, if you come across it, is the 6x9 Kodak monitor with
Yeah,
the
I've seen
special
those.
anastigmat lens. Mike
Yeah.
Ekman calls it the folding Kodak
The folding
Medalist.
Medalist. Yep.
And the problem is they're plagued by the crappy bellows that a lot of those that period of Kodak have. But if you can get one that works, or at least one that you don't mind leaving it open and covering it up with liquid latex,
Oh, I love repairing
it's got some
stuff.
really cool features on it. It's got like a film advance mechanism in it,
Oh, wow.
and that super anastigmat lens is fantastic.
Yeah. The any camera you find from that era with either they at first they called it the Anastigmat Special, and they would usually write special in red. So people will call them red letter lenses, but then they later renamed those to Anastars. They're great.
My Vigilant has an Aniston 105mm f4.5.
So the Aniston is a step down from the Anastar. They're still good. They're still very good.
And they flare a lot.
They flare, and you do get some softness near the corners, but when used correctly, it's going to look good. You know, it's important to remember Kodak was a film company then. They made, with rare exception, throughout the entirety of their career or history of making cameras, Kodak produced cameras to sell more film. So they did not always need to produce the highest quality of anything. They just needed to make stuff good enough to make good looking pictures so that people would continue to buy film. And that's why you get cameras like the Signets and the Motormatics, even the original non-rangefinder Kodak 35. Those are great cameras and they make excellent images, but they're rarely highly sought after by collectors because they weren't prestige models.
Yeah.
You know, you had the Ektra, but I mean, that's a tiny little blip. You know, the Medalist is a great camera, but it was made for the military. You know, they sold a few of them to regular people after the war was done. But by far, your average 1950s family wasn't taking a trip to Niagara Falls and shooting slides with a Kodak Medalist.
No.
So I have a question for the camera dealers regarding the old Kodak folders. So I was going to show it, but it's not really relevant. I have a Kodak Autographic number one special Model A, pretty nicely featured for a pre-World War One camera. The reason I got it was it takes 120 film, not 620 film or 616 or any, like I can take a roll of film, modern film, and put it through the camera and it still works. And, but you know, it's the lens is kind of cloudy and I don't really use it. I've got, you know, a Zeiss folder now and all that. So I was going to sell it and I it was hard to find that model, but from the sold listings I looked at, it still goes for just a couple tens of dollars, the same as a number 1A, which takes 620 film, or a number 2, I forget. But it seems to me the market doesn't really put a premium on those few Kodak cameras that do take 120 film. Am I right there? Or?
Yeah, that's correct. You're right.
Yeah.
I mean, they also made so many, and people aren't going to shoot them anyway. I mean, they're going to go on a shelf.
I see. Okay.
So very few people are going to take pictures with them.
So I think I'm going to just keep it.
Yeah.
You know, it's got seal skin for the covering. It's got Bakelite top and bottom plates, which was interesting for pre-World War One.
I've done a review of almost that exact camera, Howard. It's on my site and it's got the seal skin, everything. It's got a Zeiss lens. It's a Bausch & Lomb Zeiss lens on a Kodak, shoots regular 120. Remember 620 and 616 didn't come out till like 31, 32.
I see.
So anything that Kodak made before then was the regular film.
Yeah.
But you're 100% right. You're rarely going to see anybody paying more than $10, $20 for any old folding Kodak. The only exception, and it's barely an exception because they're still not worth a ton, but some of the Nagel Kodaks, like the Valenda, there was a very short-lived model called the Kodak Regent, which was a German Kodak that's, you know, maybe $50.
Okay.
Model 35 with the Ingenue lens.
The French version. So there's a small market for some of the less common Kodaks, but the problem is that even if you do have one of the rare Zeiss Kodaks with leather bellows, no pinholes, and everything works fine and it's rare, the problem is most people don't know what it is. So they're still not going to pay a crap load of money for it.
Okay. Thanks.
We're talking about 6x9, but if we can expand that to 6.5x11, so 1/16 cameras, here's one I brought back from the crypt just the other day. This is the number 1A Speed Kodak. So this behemoth is actually a Fulmer and Schwing Graflex, originally made as an SLR, but Kodak relabeled it under their own name and got rid of the reflex mirror and just made it a viewfinder. And what's really neat is you could look through the viewfinder straight on, or there's this little 45-degree mirror that when you flip it up, you can shoot it at waist level. But the thing that's the most, and this is what a Speed Kodak was, But if you don't know, when you hear the term speed Kodak, it means it has a focal plane shutter.
Oh,
so
wow.
This 6.5 by 11 fairly large folding bellows camera, when new, of course, it has a top shutter speed of 1/1000th of a second. And I looked it up. This model came out in 1909. So to have a 1909 folding Kodak with a focal plane shutter with it that can freeze motion at 1/1000th of a second is pretty amazing. And even more amazing, I've done the flashlight test and both curtains have no holes in it. The shutter actually fires. There's two ways to change speeds on this camera. One dial on the left sets the tension of how fast the curtains move, and the dial on the right sets the gap. So on a typical focal plane shutter, where it's for anybody who knows, it's like the very early Leicas, the Leica Zero, where the curtains actually travel across the focal plane separated the entire way. So you can effectively change the speeds by separating the gap on the curtains. That part of it doesn't work. But the shutter, I can change the tension of it. So it'll either move slow or it'll move really fast. So I effectively still have a couple different shutter speeds on this thing. And sticking at least my cell phone flashlight through it, I don't see any pinholes. So I'm going to give this thing a shot and see if a 1909 folding Kodak speed camera still has a chance at producing images.
Was there a period when I think Kodak briefly owned Graflex?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They owned them from, like 1912 to right around the war. They actually were separated by the U.S. government for antitrust.
Okay.
So, AT&T fell victim of that, I think, what was the 80s, where they were forced to split up. But Kodak was, they had to sell off, Graflex, the division, to somebody else. But so it was a couple decades at least.
Hey, real quick, Howard, are you active in the Kony Omega users group on Facebook?
Yeah, yes, I recognized your name from that, Brian.
Yeah, I was going to say I've been seeing your stuff for years, man. It's nice to finally get a chance to meet you more or less in this way. But I've enjoyed seeing your stuff over there. You got some great stuff.
Thank you. Yeah, what I use it for these days, I actually had two for a while. It's a giant rangefinder. It's even bigger than the Fujikas and heavier. It's made out of, it was started out as a military camera, I think, for aerial reconnaissance, the Simmons brothers. I got rid of the one that had the normal lens, and I only shoot it with the 58 millimeter wide angle now. I have the accessory viewfinder, which is a really nice viewfinder, and I mostly use it to shoot infrared. So, I can, the filter doesn't bother me because it's a rangefinder for composing. And so it's mostly, spends most of its life on a tripod shooting half second exposures of infrared in bright sunlight. It's a lot of fun. And people get a kick out of seeing the sort of bolt action film advance, which does work most of the time.
Yeah, they're a cool machine. Yeah, I've got a couple. I've got like a Rapid and an M and a couple other ones on the shelf. But usually I don't take them out just because, like you said, yeah, they're a boat anchor. And yeah. I've got too many others. And that kind of actually circling back, I want to thank Mike actually earlier, Mike Butkus. Oh my gosh, the website is just an amazing resource. I actually, because I've got gas terrible, I've got just a horrible eBay addiction and too many cameras. And I'll download the manuals and keep them on my phone for when I'm going out because I can't keep track of how to run half the cameras I've got. So it's nice to be able to have all those manuals there in my pocket when I go out, actually, as a matter of fact. But yeah, the Konys are kind of, they're sitting up on the shelf looking down at me languishing. But you've got some really cool IR stuff, actually. So, and all the stuff you do on the Konys is kind of cool.
That's Kodak speed camera. I have the manual.
Oh, do you?
I reversed it. Instead of Kodak, I put down Kodak speed.
Okay, I will have to look it up because
that's a really rare camera and manual. I happened to find some guy in the UK. I was searching for something, and this store in the UK had it. And I'm like, what is this one? And I searched for it. Nobody had that manual, and he wanted like $10 for it with, $5 shipping from the UK. I was like, sold.
Well, I will definitely – is that one you have online? Because I looked, and I didn't see anything.
Oh, yeah.
It's there. Okay, I'm gonna have to look again. See, just like I said earlier, sometimes you have to try different variations of the name to find the manual, because that one's a little odd in that there's two ways to fire the shutter. And from what I gather is that in timed mode, there was a separate button that would actually activate the shutter. So I it would be nice to get some clarification on how that works.
Is it hard to shoot 116 camera, or is it just something you put some spindle, put some extensions on a 120 spindle and...
Most of the time you can do like exactly what you said. You could either get the adapters. It's what's the name of the company in Italy that makes a lot of the 3D adapters? I can't remember their name. You could either get an adapter to use 120 on a 116 spool. In some cameras, you can just loosely roll it on there and just hope that it crosses the way you should. But if you can find some real 116, I've had okay luck with Verichrome. If you could find some 116 Verichrome stock, there's a good chance it's actually still usable. The biggest problem for me, the few times I've ever tried to shoot 116, is developing it, because none of my reels can fit 116. I have one Bakelite tank that technically can do it, but it's a non-ratcheting kind, and getting it, you know, for one, usually any film of that era that's that old roll film is so curly. Getting a ridiculously curly film to roll onto a Bakelite spool that doesn't ratchet, it's a bit of a challenge. So even though I do have some 116 film that probably is viable, it's the thought of shooting and then later on having to go develop and then scan it, because there's no holders for a flatbed scanner for 116 either. So
the Film Photography Project actually sells a 116 to 120 film adapters for like $20.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a better way. You can actually get, if you could find bulk 70 millimeter, because 116 is 70.
Oh, they sell that too. They sell 65 millimeter bulk roll.
Yep, so you can get it with the dual perforations, and you'll just have perforations running through your image if that's okay with you. Or any kind of 70 millimeter film will technically work in a 116 if you're willing to re-spool it. So there are options. I think Anthony recently did a 116 camera using 120 film, and you get a slightly panoramic look to it. You get the 11, so it comes out to be like 6x11. It's not quite panoramic, but it's a little bit more than 6x9. But you were talking about the Simmons Omega, which is what the Kony Omega was based off of, and I have the flash, so I love this flash. If you look at it, it's like a big pinwheel.
That's a wild flash.
So you shoot one and then the thing spins around, you got your next bulb ready to go to keep going. And then complete segue, if any of you have Amazon Prime, check out the show Fallout. It just came out. It's based off of the Fallout series of video games. It's quite good. Even if you're not a gamer, you don't need to know the game to be able to enjoy the show. But it takes place in this like apocalyptic future where people have been living underground, and you know, but they have the technology of like the 1960s. So in the first episode, you see several scenes where they're shooting with a Kodak Hawkeye Brownie. And I want the model they have, because the flash just keeps going off. You never see the guy change the bulb.
Fallout is a very interesting IP, because I'm like 23. I've played most of the games, but the story in general, it's a fascinating setting.
Have you seen the show?
Yeah, I have actually. It's fantastic.
It's really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would recommend it for anybody. I don't care how old you are. I'm 45. I've played the Fallout games too, but you don't need to know anything about the game. It's a good TV show with some science fiction.
And it has Walter Goggins.
Walter Goggins from The Shield. He's great. So anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to make the spot that, but I saw my rapid fire bulbs and it made me think of the TV show where you can keep shooting a flash bulb camera and it just keeps going and going and going and going.
Mike, in Kurt stuff, did you get a funny Omega Flex?
TLR?
Oh yeah, there you go. That's the honker.
I have two lenses for it too. This is the 135, and I have another lens somewhere. I don't know where it is.
Now that's the money. Those things are not cheap.
I used to shoot weddings with those.
Do you have a scale? Could you weigh that for us, Mike, sometime? I've always
about 6 pounds.
I might have asked this on another show, but I've always wondered what those things
were. Right. I do. It's in the other room. I'll be right back.
Okay.
I actually wanted to ask an interesting question that's been kind of brewing in my mind the whole time I've been here. I want to know what are some of the best bargain deals y'all have ever gotten on a camera?
Oh, geez. Don't ask a dealer that.
Everyone is like,
you
is
don't
like,
want to know.
Everyone is just like giving blood.
Yep.
Because
yep.
Recently I picked up a Bronica S2A. Nothing wrong with it except that it didn't have a dark slide for 170.
Oh, that was okay. I mean, yeah. An S2A was that's a very nice camera.
Yeah, I've been enjoying the hell out of it.
You'll probably pay $50 for a dark slide if you can find one.
Oh, I got one for about 10.
Oh, that's okay then. You did good.
I had to do the foam repair on the focusing screen, but that took me like 5 minutes.
I tried to, yeah. I cracked the mirror and I cracked the focusing screen trying to do that fix.
What I did.
And I'm still using them. I bought a third-party screen from China, and it was garbage. So I've gone back to using the cracked mirror and the cracked screen. I get better focus on those.
Talk to Rick Olison.
Yeah, I was just about to say bright screen.
I seem to keep on lucking into SX70s for $10 a pop for some reason. I never set out to find them, but I keep on stumbling into them.
Before I forget the numbers, 2,780 grams or just over 6 pounds, 2 ounces for this thing.
Thank you.
I have the hood on the back, which is mostly plastic. There's the roll film back. And then, like I said, this is the 135 Hexanon. So if I had, I imagine it would be probably like a 100 millimeter, probably the standard.
I think it was a 90.
90, yeah.
There's a right angle back so that you're looking down like on a twin lens reflex, but I think it's probably a mirror, not a prism, so it wouldn't really weigh much differently.
So, Mike, is that a dry weight or is that loaded? Is there film in there? I mean, there's how much difference is that?
There's no film. There's no film in there. I mean, if I added a roll of film, you know, add a few grams, but
it's almost what my S2A weighs with like one of the 50 mil lenses on it.
Yeah.
Does that have three shoes on the top, just like the Connie Omega Rapid? Like you can put a light meter, a flash, and something else on the top all at the same time.
Because that's what it needs, just a big Mets flash. Yeah. It's just a big Mets flash.
On my Kony Omega for fun, I got one of those cold shoe adapters that's double-ended. So for one of the slots, I put one of those little Minolta 16s on there. So I have a little tiny camera on top of the camera.
Oh, that's amazing.
I had a friend recently passed away, had shot weddings for years in New York with a Graflex speed graphic. And when there was a stereo craze for wedding slides in stereo in the early 60s, he would have something like a stereo realist clipped to the top of his Graflex so he could shoot them both.
Wow.
The whole thing must have weighed about 12 pounds.
When I was weighing that thing, I heard you guys ask the question of like best pickup. And it's hard for me to answer. And I suspect Paul's the same way. It's because a lot of times you get a group of stuff and you end up selling parts of it. And from what you keep, you've effectively gotten it for nothing. But I'd say the best actual purchase for what I paid and what I got and what I kept would have been an estate sale maybe 2 years ago. I'd seen this estate sale on the south side of Chicago, and this guy had a boatload of just old Instamatics and cheap stuff. But he ended up having what I thought looked like Nikon rangefinder boxes, the blue velvet boxes that a lot of Nikon rangefinders came in. Couldn't see any cameras, but I went on the whim of it looked like the box for a Nikon rangefinder. So I drove all the way to the south side of Chicago, like Chicago Ridge or something. And I had to wait in line to get into it because I wanted to get there early. I finally get in. I make it to the room with the cameras. And at first I didn't see them, but it turns out someone had just moved them. And sure enough, there was an S2 in excellent condition. In fact, that's the one Anthony has right now. And I got four lenses for it, all with the original viewfinders too. So I have like the 85, the 135 with the correct, you know, piece. Everything had the EP, the post exchange markings on it, which by itself doesn't add any value to any of that stuff. But the fact that every single piece, lenses, body, everything had that mark on it suggests that whoever owned this camera bought all of it probably at the same time, you know, probably in Korea or somewhere, you know, on deployment or something like that. And I think I paid like $200 for it. Oh, and I remember when I was walking out, like I was like shaking. I was so excited. So while nothing's as that doesn't compare to getting something for free, I'd say that's probably my best pure value pickup, something like that for with all the lenses.
That's pretty awesome. Those are awesome cameras too.
Yeah. But we're starting to wind down here. Always great to see some new people. Brian, I mean, thank you for coming on, Jordan. I think it's hilarious that, Jordan, you met Anthony at that Atlanta show, because we talked about that. And he had mentioned that it was definitely catered more towards like influencers, you know, and YouTube stars.
Sort of, yeah. But there was also a lot of other people there who were just passionate about photography. Okay. I got to meet a lot of awesome people like Anthony and a couple of other people.
And Brian, you've run into Howard on the Coney groups too. You know, we're all part of a community tied together by Mike Butkus's camera manuals. My website has become kind of a verb. You know, that's a running joke that we have. And I've shared this story before too, but I never intended on making a camera site with my name. Like if I had known that's where I wanted to go, I would have given it a cool camera sounding name. In fact, in 2017, I had tried getting Camerosity.com. I've been enamored with that name for years because I love the history behind it being Kodak's Little Orphan Annie decoder ring for the year something was made. But if you don't know what it means, you hear the word Camerosity, at least it sounds like camera or camera city or something like that. And I had wanted to get Camerosity.com, but the guy that owns that domain will not let go of it. So I gave up on my dream of having a camera sounding website. So when I created the podcast, I was like, well, that we'll have a Camerosity podcast. And that's where the name for this one came from. Oh, that was Cocaine and Waffles for the first two episodes. But that's when we were not really sure we were going to do this. But anyway, I don't want to retread that topic.
All right. So, Mike, we'll try to remember. We need to put the link on the show notes of where people can go to support Mike Butkus's endeavors.
Send Mike some money. I mean, like I said before, everybody on here has been benefited from his information. And on top of that, I really do think that just camera collecting as a hobby is unique. I seriously doubt that there's a vintage guitar collector's manual website or vintage car parts or stamps or any other hobby. I can't believe there's something comparable to what he has for other enthusiast groups. So it being in the photography, whether it's flashes, exposure meters, lenses, cameras, to almost within reason be able to search for practically any camera and find a manual, at least something close enough to help you use it, is really remarkable.
It is. And also, we should also mention that if anyone really, really is looking for information on Russian telephones, they can go to Mike Butkus's website, and he has an entire page on Russian telephones.
I saw that. Yeah. I wonder if that was by accident or maybe an attempt to branch off into a new hobby.
When I buy a manual, I check other things for sale. So the Russian, I have something about trains on there.
Your website is fantastic, Mike. There's so many things on it to look at.
Russian I have the World's Fair. I have three World's Fair booklets on there, and they're interesting to go through, to go back into 1934 about what the future looked like, you know, flying cars. So that's how I pick up so many things on the side. Cool. I look at what else I have. World War II airplanes, the cameras that they use when they shoot the guns. Well, these cameras shoot 16 millimeters. I have two or three of them. I have a couple of aircraft cameras, the ones that they use in World War II to shoot the ground. But that's how I find that. I always check what else they're selling for. I have a 1923 Rolls-Royce repair manual, because somebody was selling that. And I've had at least four people ask for it. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, here it is.
Very cool.
You never know what people want out there.
Well, just remember, you're a camera manual site first, so don't get cocky and start branching out into too many different things.
Oh, no. No. Like I said, I got three or four of them to do after I found a box in the living room.
Well, we will certainly put the word out. Not that we're some huge podcast by any means, but we are the world's number one open source film photography podcast. So we'll see if we can get you at least a few things that you don't already have. Maybe you'll see a small spike in donations following the show. It usually takes us about a week or so to get this thing edited and out, so people won't be able to hear anything we're saying, probably not till this week or early next week. So everybody look forward to that. But I want to thank everybody else for coming. Did anybody else have anything last minute that they wanted to talk about? Theo?
No, that's it. I think it's a wrap, mate.
All right. So we had talked at the last episode about doing a Cameras of the 70s show. We decided to bump it because we really were excited to talk to Mike. But I think it'll work out for the best because our next episode will be episode 70, and we will then discuss Cameras of the 70s. So rather than it be a specific brand or type of camera, we're going to cover an era. We found a couple, what other websites said were top 10 best cameras from the 70s, and we'll give our opinions on that, maybe some critiques there. After episode 70, I don't know what the ones after that are going to be. Paul's going to be taking a trip to Ireland, so we may end up taking a break. We'll just have to see how that goes. As always, the topics and discussions on the Camerosity podcast are influenced by you guys, so we love having repeat listeners. We love having new guests. Thank you for coming on, Jordan and Brian. We look forward to having you back. Don't wait to be invited. Just come on the show and share with us your new pickups. Ask any questions. If you are listening to this and haven't been on the show before and are intimidated, please don't be. We're just a bunch of dudes sitting around, you know, that love this hobby. So if we had the ability to sit around a coffee shop and do this, that's what we'd be doing. But instead, we do it over Zoom. So thank you guys for coming, and everybody have a great rest of your week.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Night. Night. Cheers.
Bye, everybody.
Yeah.
Episode 70 is not going to be about the Mamiya 7. Seriously?
I wanted to use my 645 as half frame 6x9.
At one point, I had a Brian Adams Summer of 69 joke that I was lined up to lob to Howard because, you know, Brian Adams is Canadian, but
right.
The moment passed because you said that you got the Mamiya 23 in 69. Uh-huh. So I had it in my head. I was going to do a Brian Adams Summer of 69 joke, but again, it didn't work out.